In today's episode, we're talking about scandal. That's right. We're not talking about presidential scandals or political scandals. We're talking about pastoral scandals, and we're curious as to why they just seem to keep happening. Today's guest is the Reverend Jake Morrill, who has got a lot to say about that, and we are excited, and I hope you will stick around for this podcast because we've got a good one for you. It's true. If you think about it, there have been some pretty big scandals over the years. I remember when Ted Haggard, the president of the National Association of Evangelicals, was disgraced. I remember when Bill Hybels, the senior pastor of one of the largest churches and most innovative churches in America, Mark Driscoll, you name it, big high-profile pastors have trouble. Why is that? What is it about pastoral ministry that is so fraught with bad behavior?
Fraught. That's a good word.
Mark, this is a big one. This is a crazy topic to take on. Why are we doing this? Why are we talking about this?
Because I thought it would be fun. I thought it'd be a great topic, especially with Jake, who I love and trust, both for his pastoral background and his counseling, coaching. I think he's the perfect person to have this conversation with. Jake knows scandal. He can handle this.
Jake knows scandal.
That's right. Jake, I'm talking to you here from the Anderson County lockup, just with a...
right outside Clinton, Tennessee. All right. It's the maximum security facility and everything. Yeah, well, Jake, it's great to have you on the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks. Great to be with you guys and excited to talk about scandal.
Dun, dun, dun. Well, just so you know, the name of this podcast is Can the Church Be Saved? And so we always like to begin whatever we're doing by going right to there. Before we even get into scandal per se, curious what your reaction is to just that basic question, can the church be saved?
I think the institution is heading toward destruction, and I think from it, the church will rise again, as it always does. Probably not the first person to talk about Phyllis Tickle's idea of the 500-year yard sale every 500 years, and the church, all the current norms get brought out onto the lawn and reevaluated. Most of them get thrown away, but... yeah, so I think it depends on what you mean by church. Some of it's already in the dustbin of history, and some of it is just starting to sprout.
Holy sh! I don't know what we're. This is going to be crazy today. This is going to be crazy. This is going to be fun. I'm excited about it. This is the kind of conversation that I live for because it's a. Well, I don't know about you Unitarian Universalists, but we Christians in the Methodist tradition believe in resurrection, right? Death and resurrection.
I've heard something about that.
And sometimes in the church, we forget about the death part. So I'm really, I'm excited about this.
Right.
Yeah, Mark, we've got some business to take care of, though. We've got, before we get started, first of all, I understand you are headed into, like, vacation mode pretty soon, right?
Oh, my goodness, it is the truth. Annette and I are preparing to go to Maine. It is our place. She grew up going there in the summer. It was her place, and when we got married, that was like a condition. If we marry, you will love Maine, and... shockingly, I did. And so we're getting ready to head up there for a little bit of time. And I'm ready, I have to admit.
Maine is it's a decent place. It's a nice place. Yeah. Last year, I actually met you and you were doing a sabbatical in Maine. Was it just last year?
It was just last year, and I do happen to remember that.
And yeah. And we came to visit you, and it was incredible. It was transformative just for me, and it was really a pretty short period of time. But here's the fun thing. I follow this YouTube channel, which has it's two people that are – it's a husband and wife that are trying to sail around the world and stuff, you know, and having good starts and stops, but they had just bought a new boat, and they were and they bought it in the Northeast, and I'm watching one of those episodes. They're in a restaurant, and the camera pans around, and there is Mark and Annette Flynn on the screen. I jump out of my seat. It was unbelievable.
Well, we like to hobnob with, you know, the celebrity here and there. We don't like to make a big deal of it.
Yeah.
That's right. That's the word I'm looking for.
Influencers. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, this podcast is undoubtedly going to turn you into an influencer also. So this is great fun.
Add to the mystique. I love that.
I know. Okay, so we have to remind our listeners that this is a sponsored podcast, and we have a very special sponsor this week. Yes.
We do indeed. We're starting to talk around here about Christmas shop and Thanksgiving shop. I know it's still a little early to think about Christmas gifts, but we've got a great suggestion for you as you go down that list that you're making. Our sponsor today, Inspirational Quotes by Kaz Walker.
That's right. Who is Kaz Walker, by the way?
For those who were not raised in the luxury of East Tennessee in the last 40 years or so, you miss the opportunity to be overwhelmed by a personality, a politician, an owner of really bad grocery stores that had really cheap, cheap merchandise named Kaz Walker. And Kaz was at one time on the city council. Kaz was mover and shaker in Knoxville, and it is rather horrifying to think about how much he influenced all of us. And he had a sponsored home and farm hour earlier in the morning, like 5:30 or 6 a.m. And so many of us grew up listening, whether we liked it or not, to Kaz.
It was that time when, if you stayed up late enough at night, the flag, you know, the national anthem came on, and then, you know, the TV screen went to noise. And then, you know, a few hours later, the first thing was the Kaz Walker Farm and Home Hour. And I remember it well. And just remember watching it thinking, I don't believe this is a real thing. And now we have this book of inspirational quotes as a sponsor. It's amazing.
Do you
remember Kaz?
I sure do. Yeah, I remember he was on he got in a fist fight when he was on Knoxville City Council that went national news. And he was against the switching to daylight savings time because it would add an hour of sunlight to the day, and that'd be bad for the farmers. So he had all kinds. He was.
He was one of the few people that was against the World's Fair coming and was a staunch advocate that we not let all these foreigners come to Knoxville. We didn't need them.
Yeah. 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 It's great.
We wonder about the xenophobia of today's age and we wonder where it came from. I don't know.
Yeah.
But he did launch Dolly Parton. So gotta, you know. Played a foot.
That is exactly right.
I will say
he also hired people of every race. That was one edge. He really did care about the poor and did not mind at all hiring people who were struggling and destitute of all racial backgrounds. So I'll give him that at the very same time of being xenophobic and political bait. Oh my gosh. He had his own newspaper called The Watchdog, wasn't that it? That was just god awful. And I mean that literally, god awful. God frowned when that thing was produced. But anyway,
all right.
On to the show.
I'm gonna get out of here, Mark. I'm gonna step aside and I'm dying to hear what you guys talk about.
Me too. I am so excited to welcome Jake. Most of you, I dare say, know who Jake Morrill is, but just to remind you, he was a lead minister of a congregation here in Oak Ridge for 19 years. He just retired from that position, stepped down, and is now a leadership coach. He works with companies, the companies that want to have a greater emotional maturity and more effective management, especially in relationship. He is, and this is what's exciting for me, a longtime student of Bowen Family Systems Theory. In fact, he's even on the faculty of the Bowen Center for the Study of the Family in Georgetown. He's a published author. He is my friend, Jake. I'm so pleased that you are here. And you've already started us down the right path. That this distinction, I'm talking about can the church be saved, that you immediately make between the institution of the church to what is the true nature of the church that we have to live into, I think that's exactly where we want to go. But I want to start by asking you, if you can explain, I love Bowen Family Systems Theory kind of stuff, but for those people who don't know what that is, could you give just a quick thumbnail of what family systems theory is all about?
Yeah, generally the idea is that instead of labeling people as good or bad, or this one's got this problem or diagnosis or that one does, it says problems and the resolution of them is found between people in relationships and in relationship networks. So it just shifts the focus, widens the camera lens to seeing what's the whole family doing, the whole congregation, what else is happening other than the good person or the bad person.
Yeah. So, and I know my background with Rabbi Ed Friedman, he talked about how applying that theory to churches was and synagogues and mosques is a really reasonable idea. Do you agree with that? That this is not just about nuclear family, but about bigger groups as well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I leaned on that throughout my ministry. It got me out of a lot of trouble, and got me into a lot of trouble. One of the things that Ed Friedman said, just to give people a taste, is when somebody's in the hospital, don't go visit that person in the hospital. Instead, go visit with their family. Now, I don't know any pastors out there who are getting their phones blown up. You need to go visit. You need to go visit. You know, that pressure. But that's how he was always doing bank shots about sort of looking at what, you know, how can I play this that's different from the expectation?
And, you know, you just, I love that. That sounds like Ed Friedman. I had the pleasure of meeting him. We invited him to Fountain City to speak, and I got to be the one that picked him up at the airport and drove him around. Oh, my goodness, what a great guy.
Yeah.
Character. But exactly what you're talking about, the to understand church is to understand both the institutional side and the real who we are called to be side, representing Christ and all that. But we're talking about systems of emotion and chronic anxiety and people who are healthy and unhealthy and how we all have to work together, right? I mean, church, we need to pull back that veil and see church for what it really is, to if we're going to answer this question to begin with.
Yeah, to understand it, I mean, to understand it not as a refuge of the perfect over and against a fallen world, but, you know, as a place where all of the dynamics, all of the struggles, all the mixed baggedness of the world is right there in it. So, you know, and to be aware of it and to just see it with some objectivity is how I'd say it, and some honesty.
Yeah. And I think you said that well. The fallen world, we see that in church as well. I pulled out a few statistics because when we ask the bigger question, why do so many high-profile pastors have scandals? My mind immediately goes to two things, sex, sexuality issues, scandal, and money. I know there it's more than that. There's narcissistic behaviors of all kinds and emotional abuse, but and I mean, as we started, Steve lists people like Ted Haggard and Bill Hybel. We have in our own Methodist denomination, Kirby John Caldwell caught up in a money scandal. We have Jimmy Swaggart is like the godfather of scandal and how the church deals with it poorly. So we have some statistics on sexuality scandals and money scandals, but let's just start by asking you, just your initial impression, why do so many high-profile people get into trouble with scandals?
I think anytime a family produces a Jimmy Carter, there's also a Billy Carter there in the shadows. Anytime a family puts up a Bill Clinton, there's a Roger Clinton there. Often, pastors coming out of families are the high achievers in a very particular way. They're not wired. The pressure isn't that they get rich. The pressure is that they be publicly good and that they fly the family flag as the publicly good people. That is a lot of pressure that doesn't leave much wiggle room for them to be human. So that's what I'd say. And I guess I'd say the higher the success, the more I start worrying about people. To the extent that the success is forged on a caricature of humanity, that somebody is seen to be perfect, flawless, the exemplar, the ideal. And I just think that that is not, again, to the system's view, that's not that the person is bad or a villain. It's that they are performing to the expectations of their family and then later on to the expectations of the congregation. A mentor of mine about 7 years ago was arrested for child pornography. And in reflection, after that, some of my cohort and I, as we were talking, we were like, well, of course, we all treated him like he was the second coming of Jesus. I mean, he was like, and he wasn't a high-flying person. He lived in a poor community and provided meals and was just like, you know, so inspiring. I don't think that guy had any place to say, hey, here's something I'm working on. Here's something I had struggled, because we wouldn't have been able to hear it. We would have been allergic to that confession. We needed him to be perfect. So I'm just saying,
I love how
part of it.
Yeah, no, I love how you're wrapping us up into it. It's not, when you talk about scandals in the church, it's not about those people, those pastors who fall. It's about our expectations. We project onto that. We're part of the system, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I guess I'd say that you talk about money and sex being like the vehicles of the, you know, the scandals. I'd say that in a way, those can be focal points, especially sex for conservatives. And I was trying to think coming on here, you know, well, how does that look for liberals? And I think, you know, I read this book about 15 years ago that was talking about liberal parents confusing their children, because liberal parents are often preaching compassion and empathy and equality. And then their children just see these bloodthirsty, ambitious, opportunistic careerist, you know, households. Yeah. The adult behavior don't match the message of compassion. So whether it's left or right in whatever sector, I think it's about the honesty, to say, I'm a mixed bag, and to unhook from either side. And it's no mistake that the scandal, I mean, even scandal is an electric, anxiety fueled word, that shows up through whatever the taboo is, whatever the thing that's off limits.
I find it, you know, I know you're part of a system with the Unitarian Universalist Church where there was a call system. Yeah. We're blessed in the Methodist Church that we're appointed, and there's good and bad in both of those systems, but I'm just trying to imagine the call system pastor who shows up and says, well, you know, I'm a mixed bag. I'm not... Are we ready for that? Do you think congregations actually want us to be human and say, well, you know, I struggle with some porn every now and then, but I've got it under control right now?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. To what extent is ministry an ongoing sales job to BS the people that were, you know, somehow better than them and different from them? I run the fundraising for the Bowen Center, which is just a great, how to be objective from this perspective. And I was saying, well, testimonials are pretty common fundraising tools. And the director of the Bowen Center said, yeah, but you know, not everybody has a great experience with the programs here. And I was laughing with him. I was saying, well, what if we found somebody who was really disappointed, who said, you know, I tried that out, it just doesn't work for me. And I said, we could have the tagline, still trying hard after all these years and probably getting it wrong. So, you know, But you don't hear fundraising efforts like that. So I don't know.
I love that, though, because there's a bunch of us. I mean, think about it. We're in this season where Christendom is falling apart, this whole cultural movement that assumes everyone's a Christian. Everybody goes to church. The question is just, where do I go to church? I wonder how many people who have been so turned off by that facade. I love, how did you say it? We're constantly selling the idea that we're better and living in that illusion. I wonder how many people would like that breath of fresh air going, well, you know, we're not as bad as we were. Come down to the.
That's right. Yeah, it's the shift from, I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see, to I once was lost, and now I'm a little bit less lost, and sometimes I still get lost. You know, that doesn't inspire a certain kind of confidence that people are looking for, but in another way, for me, that inspires the confidence of credibility. This is somebody who's going to tell it to me straight. But
oh, yes. Being that straightforward pastor, that's an art form, isn't it? To just say, I'm just shooting from the hip. But carefully selecting what you pull out and shoot from the hip. Carefully selecting when we are honest about our failures and we hide the really... I mean, it goes back to this conversation that as a pastor you're having with the congregation about, I want to be open with you up to a point, because I know there's a point where you're not going to be happy. Yeah. With me if I become completely real in front of you.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, this last year was, you know, as you mentioned before, it was my last year with this longtime congregation. And I took the risk of saying two things I hate and I'm terrible at are goodbyes and receiving praise. You know, if I would ghost you all if it was up to me. So I'm going to be trying to, and I'm going to be trying to hold steady while you say nice things to me. Cause in my head, I think they're just BSing and I don't like that. For me, that kind of self-disclosure was a risk, because a lot of my ministry was, you know, the treasurer a few years ago said, you know, having you as a minister is like having Jimmy Buffett as a minister. It's always a party. It's always fun. And I thought, that sounds pretty spiritually shallow. I'm sorry, that's your experience. So
yeah,
taking the risk of saying those hard things, but you know, I'm not telling the church about my sex life. I'm not telling them, you know, even in a polarized setting, this politically charged environment with a left-leaning church, I'm not sharing my political views that skew sometimes conservative, you know? So I think, yeah, it's that political calculation, which again is sometimes the exactly what got the person to their position in the first place. It's what worked to get them there. But they're going to give that up now and start telling the truth when telling half truths and charming deception has worked so well for them thus far.
I took years practicing how to present myself. How dare you suggest I set that mask aside? This is a well-tailored mask. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I was just reading about the Stoics a few weeks ago. Marcus Aurelius, who was adopted in to become the Roman emperor as a teenager, he had this tutor who was a sophist, and the sophists were all about the art of persuasion and rhetoric and reputation. And then at about age 20, he switched to a Stoic tutor who was telling him, you know, just put on plain clothing, walk around, you're nothing special. And that ended up being how he did his leadership. And again, it's not like that's the key to success. It was upsetting to people when he'd show up wearing peasant's clothing at the Philosopher's Forum. People didn't like that. They wanted their emperor up on stage. People want their pastor up there in the pulpit. They want their pastor to have a great marriage. I've been clergy coaching for about 10 years now, and a lot of pastors, because they put 85% of their emotional energy and relationship energy into the congregation, they don't have fantastic marriages. But that's not what you put up on a billboard. You know, that's not what you put on the mailer. With people kind of, you know, the pastor and their spouse kind of looking at each other like, do we really want to go on?
There is a point at which, as a congregation, we get the pastors we deserve, right? As a congregation, we want figureheads. We want people who, I'm thinking of a very particular pastor in the Holston Annual Conference who was just a terrible person. Yeah. But boy, he could talk to rich people, and we love to elevate him because he was able to have that conversation, and you never saw the cracks in the mask. You never saw the there was no failure. I mean, that he would be able to expose himself to.
And the sad thing I'll say, because now that I'm working in the corporate sector, I'm spending time talking to people a lot wealthier than were at the church. Those wealthy people don't need to be buttered up or have their ass kissed. They need somebody to tell them the truth. That guy who's so successful about getting money out of them is not doing ministry with them. If he's in their house, he has the opportunity for intimacy that he's, you know, I just think up and down the scale, it's a conspiracy. No, I just think
you had
culture.
I was going to say, you had that seminary class on image and likeness, didn't you? About how to present yourself to look a certain way. Yes, we all did. That's just it. We absolutely did. It was just inherently inbred in the system. It was, you know, people we celebrated, they all had that down, and we learned how to look a certain way and talk a certain way.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a point in my ministry where, because I came in ambitious, I thought Oak Ridge was a stepping stone to bigger and greater, you know, I was just going to use these people and do something to add to the, and I don't know, part of it was having kids and seeing that I wasn't the center of the world, which I can still forget, but I began to admire pastors who could hold on to their humanity, who weren't always, you know, having their game face on. And that meant that some of my teachers were like the cranky ones, or the ones who were poor, or the ones who didn't know what to do. I mean, those were the people I started to follow, which was terrible for my career, but good for my life.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a professor at Duke that talked about, don't worry, in your first few appointments, they'll mold you. And he would quote himself and say, when I was a pastor of a small New England town church, when I would be out of my office at any point before lunch, people would say, what are you doing out? You should be in your study looking and working on the sermon.
Yeah.
You know, they'll tell you, what are you doing here? You're supposed to be doing that.
Yeah.
And so that expectation of being molded, it's a conspiracy. I think you're right. We kind of have to break down the walls from both sides. The pastors have to be willing to take off the mask, and congregations need to be able to accept that pastors are human. That's a terrible dilemma for both sides.
I think especially in a time of elevated societal anxiety and upheaval where nobody knows the path forward, there is the sense of urgency and the need for certainty. People want left or right, up or down. They want answers. They want solutions. And the mature leader who says, you know, I'm trying to think through this. Here are some questions I have. Here's some principles that have usually worked for me. And here's my best guess for what to do. That kind of approach is usually frustrating for the people who need a pastor to be certain and authoritative. As I say, the beginning of the pandemic, I think I may have told Steve this, the beginning of the pandemic, I started counting the ministers who in otherwise democratic congregations were being asked to behave like tyrants, to use their authority. People wanted a strong man pastor in the first month of the pandemic. And so I counted 17 clients who were telling me the exact same story. I don't know. They want me to talk about Zoom or no Zoom. They want me to decide things. What do I do? Usually they want all these meetings, and now they don't want meetings. They want me to make a call. I didn't keep track, but by June, those same pastors were being punished for being tyrants. And so I think there's the ambivalence in the congregation. Do you want a strong man? Do you want a partner? Yeah. It's in there.
Wow, this is like hit a real high point, so I've got to bring it down a notch. Why can't I be part of this conversation? I mean, this is great. I want to jump in, but I have to play the role of timekeeper and take care of our business for the day. Again, I'm so grateful we have sponsors for this program, and hope you'll patronize the one we have coming up. Please stay tuned. Looking for the perfect Christmas gift? Looking for something that says East Tennessee for your friends who have moved north of the Mason-Dixon line? May we suggest that you give all your friends and family a copy of Inspirational Quotes by Kaz Walker.
You thieves that come inside, we hope we've got it worked out where we're going to whip hell out of you and not put you in jail. For you can't put you in jail, they'll just put you in jail 10 days. We can work you up where you'll stay in the hospital 10 days.
That's right. Share the perfect gift of the season by giving Inspirational Quotes by Kaz Walker, that curmudgeonly grocer from times gone by. You'll love waking up every morning and reading quotes like this to your kids at the breakfast table.
And anybody don't like that, anybody's invited to jump on me. I'm not afraid of any bastards.
Give the gift of inspiration this year. Pick up a copy at any Borders, B. Dalton Booksellers, or Walden Books store nationwide. I mean, it's good stuff. It's really good stuff. I'm so glad that that such quality publishings and come our way. It's so cool. So cool.
And they seek us out. They seek us out as a sponsor. I love that.
It's incredible. And we're not even started. We don't even have a following yet. I mean,
well, you know.
Yeah, I think to the extent you're pitching to the Kaz Walker market, I think you're right on target. That's going to work out for you.
Well, I guess if you think about it, if we don't really have any listeners yet, maybe Kaz is the only sponsor we could get. I don't know.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm glad we've had that little break, and Jake, I hope at some point you'll tell the story about was it the story of the pink pig? Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
The pig. Wasn't there an episode at the church?
My life here, Steve.
Wasn't there an episode at the church where, like, on Bring Your Pet to Church Day, that there was a problem with this? I'm embarrassing myself.
I love the fact that we're talking about scandal, and you bring up Jake. Tell us the pig story. I love this conversation.
I want the pig story because it's a great story about leadership and about differentiation.
The pit bull. Yeah.
The pit. Oh,
when our membership director thought that a welcoming strategy would be to bring her pony-sized pit bull to stand in the threshold, and that got different reactions in the church.
We all have our stories, don't we? Yeah. We all have our stories. Oh, all right, take it away, guys.
Well, you know, as we start this conversation around why do so many high-profile pastors have scandals, I think that if we're being honest, we know it's not just a high-profile pastor issue. I pulled out a few statistics just to remind us of the state of this church institution, as we noted earlier. The Baylor University did a study called The Prevalence of Clergy Sexual Advances Toward Adults in the Congregation. More than 3% of women who had attended a congregation in the past month reported that they had been the object of clergy sexual misconduct at some point in their adult lives. 92% of these sexual advances had been made in secret, not in open dating relationships. 67% of the offenders were married to someone else at the time of the advance. So that means that in an average American congregation of 400 persons, with women representing on average 60% of the congregation, there are, on average, 7 women who have experienced clergy sexual misconduct. That's the sex side of the equation. I looked up a study done by Brotherhood Mutual Insurance, sponsors a lot of the insurance carrier for a lot of churches in the American culture. They said that they estimate $110 million a day are being embezzled. $110 million a day. They expect that to reach $100 billion by 2025 that have been embezzled in the average year. So we're not just talking about large churches, prominent pastors. We mentioned names like Ted Haggard and Jim Baker and Tony Alamo, but we're really talking about average church. What is it that, as pastors, I had this theory a long time ago that pastors end up needing, getting into sexual misconduct because they need an emotional release. That a lot of pastors, I mean, we live on being able to proclaim a message and see somebody go, wow, that really moves me. That really connects with me. But after a while, it's harder to have that emotional connection with congregations. And so they find themselves saying, wow, I'm having a really hard time making an emotional connection with the congregation, but I'm moving that one person and I'm feeling a connection here. And so the temptation is to just get the response that we're looking for so much in our professional lives. Curious, do you think that's, do you see the personal struggle in your coaching and work with other clergy?
Yeah, I do. There's some research that came out. I couldn't find it preparing for this conversation about it was after the Ted Haggard scandal. And the idea was, how do these misconductors rationalize? And part of, you know, how do they justify what they're doing? And part of what they do is they say, I have given so much, I have done so many good things. And that's the confusing thing. It's not like these are mustache twirling villains. These are people who are actually making hospital visits and, you know, and doing good for the church. In their calculus internally, misconductors are saying, it's not so bad. This one thing is not so bad. They minimize, you know, their what they do over and against the good that they've actually done. I think that there is the failure for the formational process to help clergy get grounded in the reality of their sexuality means that when inevitably, I mean, I am not that good looking and ministry involved a lot of erotic energy or that response, you give an inspiring sermon, you do something meaningful or something public and people who, you know, for whatever reasons, out in the congregation or community are drawn to that. For me as a minister, as a public leader, to keep in my head, this person is attracted to a figment of their imagination, to, you know, to a projection. This is not about me. And then to also to make sure that I am getting my own needs, I'm getting my own, you know, I'm getting enough sleep and enough reading done or all these other things aside from sexuality, that I can respond with that thoughtfulness and not with the animal reactivity of, ooh, this is exciting. It just takes a lot. And in the pressure cooker of parish ministry, sometimes ministers stop investing in themselves such that they can respond thoughtfully, or they start justifying, minimizing, you know, what it is, or they start fantasizing that the delusional impulse that brings somebody sexually toward them is actually meaningful connection.
Yeah, that struggle with transference where that person looks at you and says, well, my marriage isn't great, but look, you're this perfect woman. You're this perfect man, because it happens to female clergy as well. Look, you're just always polite. You're always kind to me. You listen to me. They're not really seeing us, the clergy. They're seeing this figment, as you said. And that's terribly tempting to say, wow, I think I am this good. I'm this nice person. And it feels good to have someone actually want to be around me.
Yeah, that's right. And instead of the real marriage at home where she's wishes I wouldn't snore so much or wishes I would take out the garbage or, you know. So, yeah, it is a challenge. I mean, yeah.
I think institutionally, let me just say from my perspective, I have followed two pastors who left the ministry because of sexual misconduct. The struggle, I think one aspect of this that pastors don't realize is the damage that is left behind in the congregation. In both of those cases, for me, it took over a year of simply building trust back before I felt like I could begin ministry. That damage of, well, how can we trust you? Look what this last pastor did. It's we're not just talking about a personal issue. It really is a communal experience.
Yeah. I also followed somebody who left after sexual misconduct. And I felt like the first 5 years I was putting Humpty Dumpty back together again, that the office of minister was too dangerous to enshrine in one person. So pastoral authority was over here in this role. And, you know, and I just had to kind of collect back the pieces little by little, earning that trust and establishing the office of minister imperfectly. I mean, I let go a staff member for sexual misconduct and then spent the next 6 months with a coach working on my part in it. And what I saw is my part in it was that I had dealt with my anger at the congregation by checking out. I was emotionally unavailable. Well, me being checked out, that attention and pressure went to the staff person. And so, you know, I just think that systems view of not saying anybody's a hero, anybody's a villain, but what's my part in it? What's the wider context in which this thing happens is that's just important.
The flip side of this, the conversation about finances, why do so many pastors get in trouble with embezzlement or funds being mismanaged, spending church funds on personal things? I completely get this because there are moments when you, as a pastor, I envy people like carpenters. That's the illustration I always use. Wouldn't it be nice if you said, see that house? I built that house.
Yeah.
But it's right there. Whereas the classic example is you preach a sermon and people say, oh, that was really great. What are you preaching next week? Right. There's no sense of accomplishment other than, and pastors fall into this trap, my paycheck represents, see, I have value. My congregation values me and I've done something. So I think that temptation to let money be a source of, see, I have worth in this community is a terrible temptation and falls in the same conversation.
Yeah, there can be a lot of shame with pastors and money, partly because a lot of times pastors are not making the same as the people who pledge. And to get into that, my worth is in my bank account. Also, pastors are often not very good at money. Personally, or, you know, over time, maybe institutionally, they learn how to read a budget. But, I worked a while ago with a congregation whose minister had left in the middle of financial scandal. I think he didn't know how to address a complex financial thing. Basically, he'd gotten overpaid and then he couldn't figure out how to pay it back, or, you know, which is not to say that he was innocent, but his shame around his financial incompetence meant that he was masking and bluffing and lying rather than saying, hey, people, I'm not good at money. I'm good at praying. I'm good at other things. So I think it's that good at all things thing gets people in trouble too.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have two questions I want to make sure we connect with.
Uh-huh.
One is, what would you like to say to pastors who find themselves struggling into this situation, struggling with these temptations? And then what would you say to a congregation about how they could support pastors who find themselves being human in what is a situation where sometimes they're taught not to be so human?
In both cases, I think it is about naming the elephant in the room. Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers, said that which can be mentioned can be managed. So I think for pastors, finding some relationship where they can say out loud, hey, here's what's happening with me and money. Here's what's happening with me and porn or whatever. And with the congregation, same thing. When there are mature elders in the congregation who can establish a relationship with the pastor where they can tell that person the truth and open up that channel of accountability and feedback and appreciation, there, that is gold. I mean, that's much better than any survey or formal evaluation, is to have four or five trusted elders who can go out for coffee and tell you what's up.
I think surrounding one of those conversations we say as pastors is every single Christian should have that group of true spiritual friends around them that will speak truth to them.
Yeah.
That's a message that a lot of pastors need to hear for themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That was, what would you say to a congregation? What would you say? How can they help foster health in their pastor?
Be aware of how the needs you're projecting onto the pastor is a way to get away from your own struggle, your own responsibility, your own efforts in your own spiritual journey. And then see if you can be partners with this imperfect screw-up that you've somehow managed to end up as your leader.
Jake, I'm curious about, this may not align perfectly with your area of expertise, but I want to throw this out anyway. The role of trauma and childhood trauma and the way that forms our personalities. We talk these days a little bit about attachment theory or attachment disorders, you know, where the bond between child and parents is not properly made, and the way that kind of spins out into various forms of narcissism. And that's one thing that I think we probably can agree on is that, you know, There are certain professions where there's an extraordinary high degree of or high number of percentage of psychopaths, sociopaths, narcissists, and clergy is one of them, right? Maybe not as bad as presidents of the United States, but it's there, right? It's part of the equation. Do you have a view on that and how that can get us into trouble and what is the solution if there is one?
Well, I work or I have worked in the last decade with both clergy and military, military families and veterans, stuff like that. And I tell them people who need to dress up in a costume to do their job, whether it's clerical robes or uniform, you know, there's some reason that is protecting them from getting to what's real often. So that pseudo self, that public self, can be seen as a defense or as a strategy to not show the mess. I think that trauma, the same event, soldiers downrange who experience the same horrific event, have very different responses. Trauma is a response, not an event. Some people coming out of that experience will do just fine, even be strengthened or wiser, and some will be destroyed. So it goes, it's not the event, but it's a background in childhood. Some people are particularly vulnerable because of family dynamics. And I think to be aware of all of the variables that go into producing that kind of pain, but also to be aware of the great possibility. I worry sometimes that popular culture has this idea that once you're traumatized, there's no hope for you. And trauma recovery actually has, trauma interventions have pretty high rates of success. So taking seriously the hope for healing and seeking it, and maybe again back to the, you know, that idea of if a pastor or if people in congregations are operating out of that vigilant, anxious, amped up place of trauma response, to have some mercy, to have some grace, to be in relationship with some understanding and compassion so that people have the time and space, even if they are the pastor, to use that pain for, you know, toward their ministry, toward their, you know, what they've got to offer. I don't know if you all have things to say about that.
I'm just thinking right now about how, you know, last year on our Thursday Lives, Mark had a series of conversations that were basically preachers on preaching. Uh-huh. And what was fascinating to me about that series and those conversations, and I think what I kind of heard in the comments that were made in the comments section, was that, you know, people hadn't thought about this very much. I think people... Mm-hmm. People imagine that a sermon is somehow, you know, this it arrives on two stone tablets kind of thing from a cloud, and is not this very human, very fallible, very conversational process that puts the pastor between God and the congregation and in conversation all with, and how really difficult and imperfect that is, and this feels to me like a continuation of that conversation. It's another way of us really maybe taking a look that is not done very often in the church, which is just a look of dang, we're all human, we're all trying, and we all play a different role in this business, but we're all trying to find our way.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't want to put, Jake, I don't want to put you on the spot now that you're still connected to the church, but now that you're no longer an active week-by-week pastor in a local church, can you say things now that you couldn't then? Have you found the freedom of no longer having that communal side of your ministry?
Yeah, I mean, part of leaving ministry was to see what the difference would be and to see, and I what comes up for me is the word niceness. I think
I love that word.
I'm professionally nice in my ministry role, and there's nothing wrong with being kind, but I think nice has dishonesty in it, and so I'm working toward a more honest life.
I love that answer. I think that's very well said. I think it is one of those temptations in ministry to put on the mask of nice and not be honest, which means not helping people. And I want to make sure we say that side. When we are nice and not speaking truth that people need to hear, it is not a gracious gift that we're offering.
Yeah.
We need to find compassionate ways to speak truthfully to people who are hurting and not just cover it all over with nice. Boy, I feel that temptation so much.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm a work in progress, probably more than most. So I'm trying for it. And I guess one of the things I do wonder is, was there a way to stay in ministry and do the personal and spiritual growth that I want to do in my life? And I couldn't figure that out for myself in ministry, but I did for a long time. I did figure out how to use ministry for my own growth, and I do think it's possible. So I guess I want to say that too, that even though I couldn't figure that out for the growth I'm after right now, I do think ministry is a tremendous vehicle for practicing intimacy and courage and, you know, all kinds of beautiful things that lead toward wisdom.
Yeah, amen. I agree.
And for those of us who don't know my history, I stepped away from the pulpit in 2005. I still keep my ordination credentials fresh and still do weddings and funerals and things like that, traditional ministry actions, but have developed, just a different kind of expression for the way I'm in ministry that, you know, has been validated in a lot of different ways, but it's, I just, I, you and I Gosh, Jake, when are you coming to DC again so we can have a beer to sit down and talk about this? Because that's rich stuff, and I really do think that it's important to think about and to talk about, especially for our colleagues. It's and the way that you do learn by stepping away, and it doesn't mean that you can't go back. It doesn't mean that you decide you're not going back. I have gone back. I have done various, you know, tours of duty in different congregations and done it with a fresh outlook. Maybe not a better outlook, but at least a fresh one. You know, honestly. We're all human. Dang it. I wish we weren't, but you know, that's the way it goes. It's that incarnation thing where Jesus is fully God, fully human. And
that's it. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think it's time, you know, the walking music just came on. Can you hear it?
I can. Well, thanks guys. I love what you're doing. And this has been such a pleasure talking with you today. And I'll look forward to that beer in DC, Steve.
Well, we don't drink alcohol. I guess I shouldn't have, you know, we're teetotalers, right? Because
I look forward to that lemonade while we're feeding the hungry in DC.
That's there's a lot of hunger in DC. So, Mark, what's next? What are we talking about next? What's our podcast next time? Do we know? We've got a bunch lined up, but, you know, what's next?
I think what's next is we're going to be having a conversation about what current research shows on dementia and where we are headed. Our connection as a congregation to the Keystone Adult Day program means that we're very much in touch with what real ministry to very vulnerable people looks like, and we want to keep in touch with what's science telling us now and what do we have to look forward to? And Lightnaker is going to join us, and I look forward to that conversation.
Me too. I look forward to this. You know, once again, we're doing something that is ended up being my favorite part of the whole week. So, folks, we're going to be dropping these episodes, around 11 o'clock or so every Thursday. Do all that stuff you do with social media. Like and subscribe. Tell some people about this podcast if you like it. Spread the word. Hey, you could even be a guest on the podcast. If perhaps a sponsor. I know that I think we're going to be having one of our sponsors that we're having negotiations with right now is Judy Smith and doing the recipe for tamales from the Mary Star Cookbook. I think that's a thing.
Nice.
I think Judy is going to hook us up there. Anyway, I'm yakking, but please do tell everybody that you can about this. And if you like it, come back. If you like it, subscribe. You can find this podcast everywhere you find podcasts, especially on the iTunes store. We're branching out and going to other places, but right now we're definitely on the iTunes store and on the church's website. All right, until next week, we'll talk to you later.